a minute ahead of time. So
great.
We'll begin our first period class with Brother Mike.
Good morning. Yeah, I showed we had a minute or two left, but it got quiet, so we'll get started. Sydney Forbes is leaving today. This will be her last class with us, so she said she'd go and take care of all the answers today since she won't be around the rest of the week. All right, so we've got a little bit to wrap up from yesterday by way of introduction or laying a foundation of prophecy, specifically in Daniel. So we, after flying through the book of Daniel to kind of give the overview, we went back to Daniel 4, and we looked at the prophecy of the seven times, and we had the young adults up here, you know, work out that answer with the numbers that we had. And we came up with the year 1917, and again, the emphasis being on that quote that we read, which is an understanding of that prophecy before that year came to pass. I was just talking with a couple people, and again, I had a kind of a critical or suspicious eye on these types of dates growing up. You know, how do we go back and we fit it in so it sounds good, but we have some understanding of these things before they came to pass, and that has helped me a lot with that these things are the correct understanding. So let's go over to Daniel 8, and we'll hit this last one here before we get into our first major prophecy in detail. And since we're using the same principle on this second example as the one yesterday, and I kind of glossed over it, but I'll explain something real quick, especially for the young people, just so you know. Again, we're not making it convenient when we add that year for year zero, just to kind of explain why we're doing that. So we're taking a negative. We have a negative number, really, because we're looking at a year of BC, 604 BC, and we're adding 2520. So we're a negative, and we're adding a number to it. If you want to simplify it to understand how it works, if you wanted to go from the year 1 BC to 1 AD, and you take those numbers, negative 1 plus 1, you have 0. So to go from negative 1 to 1 AD, you've gone 0 years. We know that's impossible. So we're adding the 1 year to account for that passing over of year 0. So just to make that logical and show we're not just, oh, we need to add a year because we have to get to 1917. That is something you have to do when you cross over the year zero. All right, let's read Daniel 8, verses 8 through 14. Jaden, if you want to start, get a couple each. Daniel 8, 8 through 14. Okay, and just a side note, there are some additional handouts up here if anyone needed those. And so we're on the bottom of page one of our handout. So we're given another time period here. This time it's a little more straightforward. Yesterday we looked at the seven times and we had to define that and interpret it. Now we're given a number, 2,300 days. And if we had, I don't think it'll happen, but if we come across some extra time in this class, we can go back and look at these references for the day for year principle. But for now, I had just noted those on the handout. So if we're taking 2,300 days and we're making that 2,300 years, now we need a starting point for this date, and this is another point with prophecy that we don't want to make convenient, right? We don't want to just find a date. It has to fit the context. And yesterday's, I think, did very well. It was a prophecy concerning Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and so our starting date was a primary date of the beginning of the Babylonian kingdom. Now, I'm not to go into too much detail here, but now we are talking about Greece, Alexander the Great being the king of Greece. That's noted here. So, and I'll just read this note here that I have concerning the context. The focus of Daniel 8's prophecy is the origin of Alexander's kingdom and what became of it after. From out of that kingdom came the little horn who took away the daily sacrifice and cast down the place of his sanctuary, referencing the temple practices in Jerusalem. Thus the prophecy's interpretation must commence from Alexander and be related to a restoration of Jerusalem to some extent. That's what we would expect to see by the context here. So, back to a little math, and this will be just the beginning. We'll be doing a lot more today. But if we're looking at this 2,300 years, and we're going to take the year that the most prominent year that we can say the Grecian kingdom under Alexander the Great began, which was 334 BC. So we have a negative 334 plus 2,300, and then we'll throw in our 1 year there. Anyone? 1967. Okay, and do you guys, does that date mean anything to you guys? Jerusalem returned to the Jews, right? The Six-Day War in 1967. Okay, and again, okay, that should be pretty awe-inspiring and impressive, but I think what helped me make it even more so was taking away this convenience factor and looking at and understanding this prophecy that was written well before it came to pass. So we'll read this bottom paragraph. This is by out of the book Reason and Revelation, written in 1868 by R. Milligan. I'll add a few words here touching the probable time when the sanctuary will be cleansed, so he recognized the context that it had something to do with that. The principal difficulty consists in fixing the terminus a quo, or the epoch, he's looking for the ending date of this 2,300 years is to be reckoned. It seems most probable, however, that this period is to be reckoned not from the rise or birth of the ram, as some writers have alleged, for he was in full strength and vigor when Daniel first saw him, but from the time he was first attacked by the he-goat representing Alexander the Great in Greece. If this assumption is warranted by the context, it fixes the beginning of this period to the spring of the year 334 B.C., and consequently it will terminate in the spring or about the middle of A.D. 1967. Now, the year alone would have been good enough, but he focuses in on the spring or middle of 1967, and the Six-Day War and when Jerusalem was taken back was in June of 1967. The hymn we closed with last night, it's the last hymn in our book. I think it's titled Jerusalem, Jerusalem. This was written after the capture of the original version. There's a lot of different versions of this. It's called Jerusalem of Gold. It was written in 1967 as a celebration of this event. It was a very popular and I think a very beautiful hymn. A more common version than the one we sang last night, and I think the original Hebrew version notes that reference from Psalm that we read yesterday, that if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand lose its strength. And so they were, their eyes and their focus was on Jerusalem, and that this was a major event for the Jews in recapturing Jerusalem. So those are a couple quick examples just to show us the accuracy and the awesomeness of God's use of prophecy. And for us, most importantly, is to look at these things, to see them come to pass, and to believe yet all the more in those prophecies which have yet to come to pass. Okay, so we're going to spend today in Daniel 5. And we're going to read, we'll start by reading Daniel 5. Let's read the first five verses. I can pick up where we left off up here. Okay, and let's jump down and read verses 25 through 31. All right, so this is for the youngest members in our ecclesia. My daughter is six. This is a story she's familiar with, and I remember hearing this as a very, very young child. The handwriting on the wall, right? This vision, some type of vision of just a hand writing a message on the wall. I always thought that was pretty cool. But it was a long time. I don't know how many years ago, in the last 5 to 10 years only, that I realized this was, you know, more than just a neat vision, and the prophecies that are contained in this message are remarkable, and they're going to reinforce the prophecies we've looked at already in Daniel. So we have this writing, Meeni Meeni Tikal Upharsin, and that's as we're told in verse 25. And if we translate that, it's numbered, weighed, divided. Now a little more detail on that. The word Meeni is it's literally a mina, M-I-N-A, or 50 shekels, and it's from the verb that means to number. So it was a currency, and which makes sense with the meaning to number. This tikal, this is actually literally better translated a shekel, which we're familiar with, and this was also used as a currency, but it was also used as a weight. This was to weigh. And eupharsin, this is literally translated half a mina, so that we looked at with that translation of mini, and it means to divide. So we have half a mina, so it means to divide, divide in half. Numbered, weighed, divided. This was the message that was given. And there's contained in here a remarkable threefold prophecy. We have, based on the translation and the meanings, we have a number prophecy, we have a weight prophecy, and we have a division prophecy. And so we're going to go through this, and not sure if we'll get through this all today. But so we're going to start off with to number, or the prophecy concerning numbering. So, and all of these have an interesting literal outcome as well. So we'll see what that means. So concerning the literal, if you flip over to Daniel chapter 9, verse 2, Brother David read this, brought this up in his class yesterday. I want to compare this verse with, it's probably the same verse he referenced in Jeremiah as well, but next reader can get Daniel 9, verse 2. Okay, so Daniel himself was reading some prophecies, some writings of God's prophets, and he understood there was a set time period for the Babylonian reign, that it was numbered and that it would come to an end. And go back to Jeremiah chapter 25. And this is most likely where Daniel was reading this and understood this from. Jeremiah 25, verse 12. Okay, so in verse 25, concerning the literal, remember it said, in Daniel 5, said, God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. And that's what we see here. He had numbered it before Babylon even came into power, that he had numbered their kingdom and it would be finished. And so that's the literal interpretation. Now we'll look at the prophetic. And if you're on page 2 of your handout, we'll spend some time here. There's a... I don't know what you'd call it, a system, a manner of study, but this Hebrew word gematria, it's a system of assigning numerical values to firstly individual letters, but ultimately to words and phrases. And a lot of other languages other than English use this, especially the Hebrew language. They've always had numbers assigned to the letters in the Hebrew alphabet. So we're going to go through the handout here. So if you young people, if you have a pencil, and there's a couple of these that I'll have to help you out at and being a little specific, because there's some, at first glance, there's some duplicate letters in the Hebrew alphabet. But for the most part, these are pretty easy. And again, you can get this chart of the numerical values online. These are known and accepted. It's not anything that's again worked out to be convenient. So there are no vowels in the Hebrew language. So in our translation, we have to pull those out. So we're left with the consonants. So let's go through these. And we gotta put a number next to all these letters. So M. You guys see any numbers in the chart up there that lines up with the M? 40. Okay. That one's pretty straightforward. What about N? 50. Okay. So that's our mini. And what does that total up to? 90. And we have Meany doubled in the prophecy, Meany, which gives us what? 180. Okay, we're doing good. Tekel, we have the T. Now, there's if you glance up there, there's two forms of T in the Hebrew alphabet. We see first you'll see Tet, and lastly you'll see Ta. So I'll just tell you this: the Hebrew letter here in this phrase is that Ta, which is the very last one. So we got 400 there. What about for the K? 20. What about for the L? 30. Okay, so what's our total for Tekel? 450. All right. Now, for Upharsin, again, we're skipping the vowels, and this Hebrew alphabet doesn't have the sound for PH, or the letter for PH is 1, and basically we're looking for the P. So what do we get for that? 80. R? 20? Was there a duplicate? I don't know if there was a duplicate R. Yep. Now, S, we have, again, a few different uses here. So the S we're looking for is this seen or sheen, and it's not that first one. So we're looking at that. They're both near the end there, the ones that each have 300. So we're 300 for S. And then back to another N, which is what? 50. All right, so what's our total for Upharsin? 630. Okay, now if we pull all these numbers down, the three different words, A, B, and C, does anyone get that total yet? $1,260. Correct. So let's talk about this for a little bit. Try to figure out what this means or what we do with this. And I'll open this question up to the adults. 1260, do we see that number anywhere else in Scripture? It's expressed in several different ways, actually, as a time period. If we want to convert that to years, let's say we're talking about 1260 days. So 1260 divided by 360. How many years are we talking about for 1,260 days? 3.5 years. Okay, where do we see that time period? 70 weeks prophecy. Anywhere else? Christ's ministry. Who said that? Elijah's drought. Okay. So we have 3.5 years, and we see at least three uses of that in Scripture. If we convert it to months, 3.5 years, how many months is that? 42 months, okay? There's actually two references, both are in Revelation 11:2 and 13:5, reference the time period of 42 months. If we look at, instead of converting it to 3.5 years, but go back to our days, the interchangeable days and years, 3.5 days is mentioned twice in Revelation as well, Revelation 11:9 and verse 11 also. Just in Daniel, if we want to just stay in Daniel, this time period is expressed a few different ways, going back to our use of that phrase, that word times. So in Daniel 7:25, we're told about a time period of a time, times, and dividing of times. So if we have a time, 1 year, times multiple, say that's 2 years, and a dividing of times, or half a time, we have that 3.5 year period. Daniel 12:7 calls it time times and a half, again the same period, and Revelation 12:14, a time times and half a time. So that's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 other places, at least in Scripture, in prophecy, that this exact same time period is used. And if you look at these, if you look at all the context of these, you're going to find that this is a time period that is reflective of trial, persecution, and Gentile dominance. So right off the bat, we can say we're dealing with, the number we came up with here, we're dealing with a very significant time period in scriptural prophecy. Okay, but let's come back to Daniel 5 and focus on that. So if we have these three prophecies of numbers, weights, and division, and we're working on the number prophecy, and that's the one that seems to have a focus on being doubled. Why was meanie doubled, right? Numbered, weighed, divided. So we already have a significant time period we're working with, but if we were to take that and say, well, maybe we should double that 1260, what would that give us? Yep, that's the number we talked about yesterday with the seven times. So either one, if you think that may be a stretch, that we double that because the number portion of the prophecy was doubled with meanie. But either way, we're dealing with a significant time period in scriptural prophecy. Now go over to Genesis 41. Genesis 41, let's read verse 32.
And Sabbath the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh's place. It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass.
Alright, so we see here in this case that God doubled the dream for emphasis, for surety, and because it would shortly come to pass, the prophecy that he was given in this case to Pharaoh. Back in Daniel 5, if we glance down at verse 30, which we read, says, "In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain." So king was numbered and finished, and the literal portion came to pass that night. So it was doubled because of the surety and because it would shortly come to pass. So the bottom line is that this is a prophecy telling of the ending of the Babylonian kingdom. We know Babylon is the head of gold and what we call as the foundation of the kingdom of men. And like Daniel 4 that we looked at yesterday, this prophecy, you know, if we're again focusing on Babylon with the context, you know, we could apply the same dates, 604 BC and come to 1917, which is the span of the kingdom of men over the land promised to his people, to God's people. Now, if we go back to the context of the way these time periods are used in Scripture, which is trial, persecution, Gentile dominance, that would certainly fit here with the time period of the kingdom of men. So remember the first time I saw that worked out, I was pretty astonished at that, how that prophecy works out there. Now we're just getting started. This next one is a little bit more involved. So that was the prophecy of numbering. And now we come to the second portion of the prophecy, which is to weigh. It says, "Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting." Right? We know that was a fact with Babylon. This was not a kingdom God set up. This was not a kingdom that would last forever. They were found wanting, or they came up short on the scale, I guess we can say. So the literal interpretation, I guess we want to look at that, would be, let's read, next reader in Daniel 5, let's read verses 22 and 23. Okay, and this is not that we need proof of this, but this is the manner in which Babylon's kingdom was found, specifically under Belshazzar, was found wanting, right? The pride that he had, especially the pride in the face of God, with using the items from the temple and not giving God the glory, which isn't surprising, but that's the manner in which they were found wanting. And again, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. So if you go to page 3 of your handout, so remember we said we're now looking at this tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. This was literally talking about the shekel, so we're dealing with both a currency and a weight. These were means of measurement that they used back then. We won't look this up. I have it on the handout here, Ezekiel 45:12. And the King James says, "And the shekel shall be 20 gerahs, 20 shekels, 5 and 20 shekels, 15 shekels shall be your manna." Now, that sounds a little bit confusing, but firstly, we want to pull out that we're dealing with some other units of weight and measurement, which is the gerah and the manna, if I'm saying that correctly. The second thing we want to get from this verse is that we're being told how many minas equal a shekel or vice versa. But in the translation, there's some confusion. I mean, that what I read there is confusing on its own. 20 shekels, 5 and 20 shekels, 15 shekels shall be your manna. Now, if it was meant to be, if we're supposed to be adding those up, that comes to 60 shekels. But the common mina was accepted to be equivalent to 50 shekels. And Ezekiel 45:12, that same verse in the RSV, you'll find some other versions that read with this, which would be considered a correct translation. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs, 5 shekels shall be 5 shekels, 10 shekels shall be 10 shekels, and your mina shall be 50 shekels. And there's some other commentary on this, and Matthew Henry, for one, says, "But it is thus reckoned because they had one piece of money that weighed 20 shekels, another 25, another 15. And he's referring to the original translation in the King James, that those were not being meant to be added up to give you the manna, but the common mina or manna was 50 shekels. So we have the Arabic names of the three weights translated into Hebrew would be a mina, a shekel, and a half mina. So when we're reading this handwriting on the wall and we're focusing on these weights and these measurements, that's what we're reading. A mina, a shekel, and a half mina. So in Ezekiel 45:12, we'll come back to that graph on top in a minute, but let's just work through the bottom part here. From Ezekiel 45:12 tells us that 20 gerahs equals 1 shekel. and 50 shekels equals one mina or manna. So, you know, it's summer break. Yeah, haven't been in math class for a while, but we've got to find our lowest common denominator. Do you guys remember that? Lowest common denominator. Can't remember what grade that was in. But we have to get these all, so we can, dealing with apples and apples, we have to get these all down to the lowest common denominator, which is a gera. Okay, so we have to figure out if one shekel is 20 geras and one mina is 50 shekels, how many geras are in a mina? We should have this on the SAT. Any ideas? The adults can think about it for a minute, and we'll see if we need to come to you. Any guesses? We want to know, yep, how many, one mina equals how many geras? Sydney, anything? One hundred, no. Adults. What was that? Thousand, yes. Sam does his stuff all day at Boeing. So one mina equals 1,000 geras. So we're just taking the 20 times 50 to get to that. That is confusing, though. So we found that lowest common denominator of geras. One mina equals 1,000 geras. So now let's fill in that bottom part, now that we know a mina equals 1,000 geras, and see what we come up with for a total. Let's go down. A mina equals how many geras again? 1,000. We have another 1,000. Yep, 1,000, 1,000, 2,500, which is what?
2,520.
All right, have we seen that before? What's that? Oh, you're ahead of us. 2,520, big surprise, right? But pretty awesome, I think, that we have this to work out like that. Now, just to kind of review that, and we'll throw in something a little extra, if you look at the chart on top, so we have these coins or these weights in Hebrew, the mina, shekel, and the half shekel. So we have this value in shekels, which is that middle row, and value in geras, which is that bottom one. So let's fill in that bottom part. So we have the value in geras. A mina equals how many geras again? 1,000, right? So we have mina, 1,000 each for 2,000. We're told the shekel is 20 geras, and then the half mina would be how many geras? 500. So if you add that row across, we get our 2,520. The other thing you can do is in that middle row, we have our 50 shekels, which equals one mina. So we have 100 shekels, and we have our one shekel, and then we have our half mina, which is our 25 shekels. That gives us 126 shekels. Okay? If we want to, we're kind of just testing this out, I guess, to see if it works another way. If we have 126 shekels and we want to convert that to gerahs, we see that one shekel equals 20 gerahs. So if we take that 126 times 20, we get the same thing, right? 2,520. So more so this second one with the weights, but remember the first time I saw both of these prophecies worked out, I was blown away. I love math, I love working with numbers, but to see this, what I thought was just a kind of a story we learned as kids from the Bible, I knew it was true, but to think that there's these intricacies and details in something like this was absolutely remarkable, and I think it shows, it adds to the versatility and the never-ending learning that we have in Scripture as adults. I continue to find new things in my study from Scripture, and it does nothing but bolster my faith and expectation of God's use of prophecy. Good job. That was the hardest part. We'll wind it down with the third part of this prophecy here. We have numbered, weighed, now divided. And that sounds like another mathematical exercise, but it's not. This is simply the prophecy, a more literal interpretation of the dividing of the kingdom. So we have, as we looked at yesterday, the ending of the Babylonian kingdom and the ushering in of, as verse 31 says, Darius the Median. It was actually ended up being a very heavily Persian kingdom. But we call it the Medo-Persian rule that came in after Babylon. They came a little bit bigger. They reigned for longer. They were more powerful. And as the metals on the image go, we would say they were less valuable. They became more base, more corrupt. So we get each of these four kingdoms becomes bigger, longer, and more corrupt, especially in terms of religion. Not that Babylon was any shining example of religion. But things seem to get worse and worse all the way up through Rome. And that was all influenced by those Babylonian stumps, that tree that was left in the ground, if you remember that. So to divide, numbered, weighed, divided. The Persians were known by the Chaldeans as Paros, P-A-R-O-S, possibly a play on the word Perez, which means to divide. But it also indicated who the kingdom would be given to when it was divided. So it was divided and given to the Persians, which known by the Chaldeans as Paros. We have this word Perez, which means to divide, so pretty interesting. It was divided and given to the Persians. And again, verse 30, that phrase, in that night, or pretty much immediately, the division was fulfilled. You go back, flip back to Daniel chapter 4. I want to look at a couple comparisons where we've seen this happen before. Let's read Daniel 4, verse 31, our next reader. All right, and this was, we looked at this yesterday, Daniel 4, when the literal fulfillment of the seven times that passed over Nebuchadnezzar when he was became like a beast. And if you back up to verse 30, what do we have? We have Nebuchadnezzar saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built? And basically, while those words were still in his mouth, this prophecy was fulfilled. It was done immediately. Go over to Acts chapter 12. Let's read Acts 12, verses 21 through 23. Again, we see something done immediately while it needed to be done. Again, this has to do with pride, not giving God the glory, and immediately Herod was smitten. Go to Jeremiah chapter 25. Let's read verses 12 through 14. Again, we're focusing on the fulfillment or even the prophecies ahead of time of what we see happening here with the end of the Babylonian kingdom. Okay, and this was basically fulfilled at that very time when Belshazzar was slain. This was the end of the 70 years of the Babylonian kingdom. Now we'll close with looking at a couple of prophecies of the rise of the Medo-Persian kingdom that were written before the fact. Go over to Isaiah 44. Read Isaiah 44, verse 28, and then also the first two verses of chapter 45. All right, this is a pretty remarkable prophecy on its own, but we have specifically mentioned here Cyrus, and what's going to happen when God uses Cyrus is the building of Jerusalem, the laying of the foundation of the temple. Now I'm just going to read a note on the history of what happened here, really that night when Belshazzar was slain, and this is the initial working together of Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. Cyrus, hearing of the great feast, and this is the one we read about in Daniel 5 that Belshazzar was having. Cyrus, hearing of the great feast, which would occupy, intoxicate, and render unfit for battle all of Babylon, opened the dams into the river to enter Babylon, beneath its walls in the channel of the river. Cyrus had risen to power some 20 years prior to this by defeating Astyages, the king of Media, and absorbed Media into the Persian Empire. Then Choresus of Lydia, who dominated most of Asia Minor, then Babylonian territory in Upper Assyria, and defeated Nabonidus, then Then Babylon, which was divided into two by the river Euphrates. He enclosed on both banks by quays protected by walls and brass gates, and we read about that specifically in Jeremiah. But as foretold in Jeremiah 50, verse 38, Cyrus diverted the course of the Euphrates, and Babylon was incorporated into the Persian Empire under Darius. So history tells us that Cyrus was leading this charge. Darius had been absorbed into his kingdom, and tells us specifically how they snuck into the city that night during that great feast, and that was the end of Babylon. All right, we'll close class, and we got through that all. I was impressed. So tomorrow we'll get into some ancient history of Israel and comparing that with the modern-day nation of Israel. Thanks.